Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Noggin Notes podcast. As always, we appreciate you downloading our shows and sharing them around if you find them interesting. We're trying to, make Earth better one conversation at a time. And if you take something away from this and implement it into your daily life, that's awesome. Today, I'm joined by a Twitter friend who became an IRL friend. That's in real life for those of you who don't keep track of the ongoing lexicon of acronyms out there in the interwebs. But Pamela Garfield Yeager and I met on Twitter through a mutual friend. Now we're all friends, and she and I have some common overlap. She's a therapist, I'm a therapist, but we also have the commonality of wanting to challenge orthodoxical thinking. In other words, the way that the counseling community writ large approaches mental health, mental illness, treatment, intervention strategies has been a way of doing things for quite some time. And there are a few of us in the community who challenge this. We question things, and that's actually what our professors trained us to do. But in a very interesting fashion, whenever we seem to do this, the very same people who trained us to question things don't themselves like being questioned. So it puts us in a weird, uncomfortable position where we see things going wrong, or maybe just not being as effective as possible, but we find ourselves pushing back against what I guess we would call an organism or a system or an establishment that really doesn't like being challenged. And I could get more into systemic thinking and operations and all that in a different podcast probably. But the idea here is that Pam and I have a dialogue in this episode about, just some questions that people don't really ask. And I think there's a chilling effect in most organizations, if I'm being quite honest, and I've worked for several, where you're not really allowed to bring topics to the bosses or the administration that seem to challenge the entire way that the organization works. And there's lots of reasons for that. And a lot of them are psychological. Some of them are just systemic. But I think in a healthy community, a healthy organization, a healthy entity, you want leaders who are going to receive feedback. And in the counseling community, we don't really have leadership. We have a bunch of organizations that have professional umbrellas attached to them. So like the American Counseling Association, the American Psychological Association, the National Association for Social Workers, the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapists, and so on, so on, so on. They all fight. They all try to carve out their own turf and terrain, and they try to recruit memberships and so forth. And they think they're doing well with, writing articles and publishing blogs and that kind of thing. And some of it probably does help, but a lot of it turns into pop psych and devolves into low-hanging fruit, and it's just not the greatest that it could be, as if they all got galvanized and became one collective voice with different nuanced approaches. And I think that the infighting really harms things. But the fact that there is no leader to whom a person like me or Pam can go and say, "Hey, look, I think we're doing this and this the wrong way, or X, Y, and Z could be done differently," we're left to appeal to the broad marketplace. And that would be the consumers, you people who pay us to, listen to your stuff and give you feedback and that kind of thing. And we're basically left to do it all our individual ways. And my opinion of this is that it's not great, because there's no uniform standard for really anything now. And even the standard bearers, which are some of those professional associations I mentioned, they don't even agree among each other what the standards should be. And so what you're left with is influence upon licensing boards with states, and the licensing boards represent the minimum competence to practice, so you can get your state authorized stamp of approval, and then you can go market yourself to the community. And then you have the influences of the professional associations themselves. Then you have the marketplace. Then you have competition in the marketplace, if there is such a thing where you live. In Nevada, there really isn't any, because there's too much demand and not enough providers. But then you have different industries that aren't even regulated by the state. So we'll take coaching, for instance. Coaches do have an international association, and they do have their own internal standards, but they're not licensed by any regulatory authority. And for some people that matters. For some people it doesn't matter. For insurance companies, you can't credential yourself with an insurance panel if you're a coach. You have to have a state license of some sort. There's that. And then there's The self-help gurus, and then there's people who write books, and there's people who host podcasts, and then there's people who maybe once were licensed, have a ton of academic credentials, and have a large following, and their research is very good, and it's useful, but they don't have the, you know, stamp of approval from the state. And so there's all this weird dynamic infighting, territorialism, turf warring, jealousy that goes on across what we would call mental wellness across the board. And among the several communities, there's not a lot of cohesive dialogue about what actually works. I think what we do is we default to things that have always been, and we keep doing them, and we don't know if they're actually effective. But in one particular area that we talk about, like suicide intervention, we're not working. We're not effective. It's not working because suicide rates keep going up everywhere, but we keep doing the same things over and over. And so Pam and I talk about that, some of the sacred cows that may have to be sacrificed down the road. And we talk about school-based mental health and how some of that may not be working or be effective. But going back to my original point, to bring this up to anyone is tantamount to heresy in a lot of circles. We're not allowed to say school-based mental health isn't working. And I'm a part of school-based mental health. Zephyr Wellness has been in school-based mental health since our inception. And honestly, we were, if not the first, we were certainly one of the first agencies in Northern Nevada to do school-based counseling. And now several people do it. And I'm all for that. But we have to wonder if we're doing more harm than good, especially on the heels of Abigail Schreier's book being dropped. It's called Bad Therapy. Jonathan Haidt's The Anxious Generation. We have to take a better look. And so Pam and I have this conversation very frank, very informally. We don't have any solutions necessarily, but we at least need to start asking questions. And unfortunately, in most of our circles, questions aren't allowed to be asked because you're inherently threatening somebody when you do that. So that's the long and the short of what you can expect out of this one. I found it fruitful. I think it's pretty robust. I think we probably could have talked for 5 or 6 hours, but to spare you people, we didn't. We cut it short at the typical hour and 15-ish mark. So that all being said, I invite you to settle in and relax and enjoy the conversation that we have. And I'm going to go drink some water and clear my throat because I am battling pneumonia right now and it is not fun. So I'm going to sign off before I start hacking up a lung into the microphone here. Enjoy the show. Hey, everybody, listening audience, welcome back. Thanks for downloading and listening yet again. I always say that, and I'm always appreciative, and I am honest when I say that I'm appreciative that people take time out to listen to what I have to say and the people I interview, because it's, I don't know, it's just always mind-blowing that you'd like spend your time listening to me. It's weird. So Pamela Garfield Yeager, hello, how are you?
Hello,
my good friend.
I'm good. Thank you.
Good to see you. You moved. You were in the used to be great state of California, now in the great state of Georgia. How's Georgia treating you?
It's treating me well. Yeah, I've made my grand escape.
That's good. You know, I'm glad that you're flourishing. You look bright and happy. And the last time we saw each other in person was in Reno, actually. You wanted to learn to shoot, and so we went to Reno Guns and Range, and my wife was there, your husband was there, my children were there, and we all fired firearms. How was that for you?
It was a great day. That was great. That was fun. Yeah. I learned a lot, and I mean, I especially like the Era 15 type gun you had me shoot.
Yeah, you did.
That we posted on Twitter, and everybody thought we looked cool.
Yeah, that was the point, right? Looking cool is more important than actually learning anything. I've wanted to talk to you about that. That's not why you're on today, but I did want to discuss that and debrief a little bit. It was months ago now, but share the audience your journey and how that even came to be, because we met through Twitter and then became IRL friends. But share that if you would, please.
My journey, like from being like a lib to now,
with you. The Reader's Digest Cliff's Notes version, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I was sort of a moderate Democrat liberal person. I'm a social worker originally from the New York area, and, you know, grew up around mostly liberal-minded people. My mother would describe herself as a bleeding heart liberal to this day. So both my parents have that mentality. I love them very much, but they didn't have that other point of view, the conservative point of view. So I didn't really hear about it. And I'm actually married to a conservative. My husband's been conservative the whole time. We got married in 2015, but we'd been together since 2010. So I've been with a conservative man for quite a long time. So clearly, I wasn't that far on the left to marry a conservative man and still obviously love him very much.
How dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you not choose one camp or the other?
Right. So I was kind of apolitical, really. And he would gently tell me things when he was reading some conservative media, and I'd be like, okay, whatever. And I didn't really pay attention a whole lot here and there. I think he was influencing me, but he didn't push it. But I didn't have strong opinions, I guess, like a more radical leftist would. But I certainly leaned more on the left. But what switched me was actually in 2020. And I mean, first there was the COVID stuff that started the process. But then it was June of 2020 when we had those George Floyd riots, the mostly peaceful riots. And then they said, call the social worker and defund the police. I'm a social worker and I've worked a lot with police with high risk populations that are very dangerous. And I knew that if it was just a social worker, that would be very bad. So I think that was my huge wake up, plus just all the black squares and the groupthink, and you couldn't say anything. I was in shock, and it just wouldn't end. It went on forever. And then the cards just fell for pretty much everything. Then I started to rethink it all.
I forgot the black squares. Jeez. I posted a black
Oh,
square,
yeah.
but it was in honor of a black police officer who got shot during one of those mostly peaceful riots. David
Okay.
Dorn in St. Louis. That was a big deal.
I remember him.
So I did a little counterculture black square. But yeah, so what about the firearms? How'd that come about? And like, how'd you find me or WTTA
You
or
were
how, I can't remember.
Stephanie.
Was it? Yeah. Okay. So Stephanie Nguyen, who has been on
Yeah.
our podcast.
We were both like early guests on her podcast. You were one of her first guests. I think I was listening to her
Yeah, she always
podcast.
compels me to
And
say
yeah.
episode number two, demystifying firearms and other taboo topics. Every
Yes.
time.
There you go. I've never been against guns or afraid of guns, I guess. So maybe I was just never a lib. I just thought I was. I think that's really what it is. I actually spent a year in Israel and I shot an M16 when I was 18 years old with the Israeli army. Most libs can't say that they've shot an M16 at 18 years old. So I've already had, probably touched a gun more than most and wasn't afraid.
That's true. You were not, but
Yeah.
you wanted to do more with it, and to the point that you came over the hill and joined us in Reno.
Certainly. I think it's an important skill. I mean, I want to learn. I'm not exactly the largest of women and toughest of women anymore. I actually used to do martial arts, but I kind of have an injury and such, so I can't do those things. And I'm a little older and not as tough as I used to be physically. So I think it's just an important skill to learn. And actually, now I'm in Georgia where I'm in an open carry state and I have a Georgia li driver's license. I can get a gun now. We did not buy guns in California because we did not want the state to track us.
Good for you.
I just think it's important. The Second Amendment's important. I recognize how important the Second Amendment is when the state really took control of my life and I couldn't leave my house and I had to wear a thing over my face and I lost my job because of mandates. I never really felt the thumb of the government like that before. And so that really showed me that the Second Amendment is important.
It's spooky, I think, and we don't like to entertain the idea of violence as an option. And as my friend Kevin Dixie would say, you only do that when you have no other choice. And that is the name of his training group is No Other Choice, because you truly, if you're backed into a corner, you have no other choice. And he does live in Georgia, by the way, where you are. So maybe I'll introduce you to at one point. But that's the idea. But we don't think of it as the government. We grew up. We're about the same age. We grew up in the 80s and 90s. It's pretty calm and, prosperous time. And you think, we make fun of Ronald Reagan saying the scariest words are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Ha ha ha, right? When's the government ever
Yeah.
done against me other than force me to pay taxes? But it wasn't that long ago that government intruded in this country into some people's lives and put them into concentration camps, you know, in the form of the Japanese internments. And that was two generations ago. So it can overreach, and it can overreach in a very violent way. And if you don't respect the idea that human beings have a right to defend themselves against such overreach and authoritarianism, then it's really quick to give that power over and succumb and trust people who don't have your best interest in mind. So we try to keep this podcast evergreen and not topical, but I think worth mentioning is that just in the last day or so, as we've been recording this, there's a chief justice, or I'm sorry, a justice on the Supreme Court who has opined that in the Missouri case on free speech, that she's saying that the government should not be hamstrung in its ability to, you know, restrict rights when necessary. And that's not her original thoughts. That came from a different decision some years prior. But the idea that the Constitution, and specifically the first 10 amendments of it, the Bill of Rights, are not there to protect citizens from governmental overreach, but instead the other way around. The government grants rights and should always have the power to restrict when necessary is really chilling. And the only defense you have against that is force. It's violence to protect yourself from government intrusion into your lives, up to and including the false imprisonment and or killing of people. And I think it's really important that we don't lose that sight of that right. You know, we have an inalienable right, and it's to be protected and held precious at all times. You know, not to have our speech muzzled, not to have our religious freedoms muzzled, and certainly not to have our self-defense muzzled. So, you know, while it's a nice sentiment to say, well, you know, I like guns because I like hunting, and maybe for self-defense against that crazy person on the street, the real purpose is to keep the government from overriding, and the government should be of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the government, by the government, and for the government. So I appreciate you saying that. And I didn't want to dwell too much on that subject because we have other subjects to talk about that also have to do with the government and how it funds or doesn't fund certain things. So I've wanted to have you on for a really long time to talk about a bunch of stuff, but you're big in the gender critical space. That's where you and Stephanie click. I really appreciate the work that you're doing. We've had her on. I had Eva Kurilova on. We've talked about that a little bit. We certainly can cover that. But what really piqued my interest is something where we overlap. I do a lot of work in suicide prevention, as people know, with Walk the Talk America and some other stuff that I haven't necessarily made super public. But we do a lot of school-based mental health. And you and I were pinging on some posts that you made on Twitter or X about how suicide prevention in schools may not be all it's cracked up to be. And this is a fresh conversation. Mind you, audience, we haven't necessarily formulated our thoughts the way that we probably would like to, but we're trying to work through it, and we're trying to think out loud and at least have a dialogue. So with that, I'm going to shut up and tee it up for you to present some stuff that you've been observing that's just made you go, are we doing this right?
Yeah.
All right, so go ahead.
Yeah, I've just been reflecting on my past experience, things that I've done, things that I believed in, and I've just been reflecting and just asking open-ended questions to myself and, yeah, a little bit to social media. I don't really even know the answers to the questions, but I'm just asking the questions. Is this, you know, the things that we believe are the right things, are they? And how do we know? That's what the question is. And the reason I'm asking these questions specifically, why it's interesting, of interest to me specifically, is I used to live near and work in Palo Alto, California, where there were two suicide clusters in the same high school. One was in 2009 and the other one was in 2015. So within 6 years of each other. So that community has been reeling from suicides, teen suicides. They also, the area has adult suicides too, but the teens are the ones that, you know, people are most concerned about. And there's even a recent one. I just heard about it. I'm not there, obviously, but I just heard about it from a parent. And so to constitute a cluster, some people have never heard that term. It just means like a group of kids did it at the same time. So the year that I was working
not collectively in mass together, but like one, then another, then another, then another.
Yeah, like sequentially. Yeah. So within the same year.
Yeah.
Yeah, one happened, then a couple of months later, then another one happened, then another couple of months later, another one happened. It was like that.
Which
throughout an entire school year.
If I may interrupt, if you're unfamiliar with this, it is a weird phenomenon. Usually that doesn't happen. If a suicide happens in youth population, it's shocking and it's rare. So to have multiple in a short time frame is why we call it a cluster. And then people want to know why the cluster happened and is there a contagion and all sorts of things. But I just want to get that operational definition out of the way. And because usually these things don't hit the news when youth take their own lives, we don't hear about them. Mm-hmm. It often gets swept under the rug, and usually,
which
or
is
at least,
good,
well, yeah. And I'm starting to change my mind on that too, because people like me who are ostensibly charged with the cleanup and the, we'll call it, postvention, when the suicide loss survivors come into the clinic, we go, why are all these people coming in? Who died? Right. And it's like, we don't know in the state office. So I've been told repeatedly, they purposely don't say this because they don't want to create a cluster. But what's paradoxical about that is two things. One, I think I as the community person who's serving these entities should probably know ahead of time. You could trust me, I'm a professional. But also, it's the same people who teach the classes on suicide intervention that say you can't put the idea of suicide in someone's head. So, like, yeah, which is it?
I agree with
right?
that.
So, anyway.
Entirely. Like, you're not putting the idea, but you might be...
glorifying it, maybe, or advertising it. Yeah, no, I get it.
The context is iffy about that. I'm questioning all of that, to be honest.
Right. Well, and that's why we're talking, right?
Yeah. I used to believe in that wholeheartedly, and now I have a lot of questions. So that did those instances did make the news. It was in the New York Times. There was a huge article in the Atlantic Magazine. You can Google gun high school suicides, and you can find those articles. I think I forgot what it was called, but it was the cover article in December of 2015. Why are so many teens killing themselves? I think it was called something like that. And, you know, there was a lot of sensationalism of it, a lot of pointing fingers, a lot of blaming. And I was on the inside. I was the head of the counseling center at the school. So I saw it. It's weird. I never met or knew any of the kids that died, despite the fact that I had met probably most of the school. And we had done so much to do quote unquote prevention. So these are the things that I've questioned now. At the time, I'll say I already didn't agree with the tactics that the school was taking, because a lot of that was really out of their own fear and really kind of wanted to cover themselves, feeling very responsible and feeling like the public is looking at them like they're at fault. So they wanted to basically do anything they can to prevent future suicides. But as they were doing all of these things and forcing me and my team to do them, we kept getting more suicides. So to be specific, what the school would do is, so there'd be the news of a child. We would hear it. We got the news privately. It was in the local paper, but they just wouldn't go into detail. And they learned not to talk about the means, which a lot of them did the same means, which was very accessible. I don't even know if I should say it. I guess for a podcast, it's okay.
Yeah, I'm guessing hanging.
Kids, no.
Oh.
Should I say? There's a train.
Oh, wow.
So there's a train near the school. It's called the Caltrain. And it goes across the Bay Area. And so that train is a really accessible means.
Wow.
So that was the main way, which is pretty horrific. Anyway, so yeah, I'm like, it's coming back to me now, like the emotions.
And, yeah, it's rough.
It was hard. So when that would happen, of course, it was devastating to all of us. And I think there was a lot of that, like we wanted to have control. We wanted to prevent. We wanted to do everything we could. And just now in hindsight, I'm thinking and believing that there just really wasn't that much we could do. I think if we'd let go of that feeling a little bit more, we actually probably would have been better. And I was guilty of that to a degree. Like I felt, you know, very responsible, and I think that didn't help. So they made us, we said what we would do is like, even, I think one happened like over the weekend, and we would meet as a team, like the counseling staff and administration, we would meet as a team, and we would put together this huge list of kids that they believed were at risk for whatever reason. Either they knew the person that died, or they had other mental health issues that they believed was a risk factor. And they went so far to even, there was a kid that died, I think it was like the day before school started, or right the week before school started. So they went through and looked at everyone's schedules, who had a class, and this is high school, so they had rotating classes, who had a class with the student who died the year before. And they made us pull hundreds of kids, this is without parental permission, of course, hundreds of kids out of their classes and basically ask them, are you okay? Are you suicidal? And yeah, they had obviously announced the news. So this was basically, they didn't let the kids have a normal day. Most of the kids that we pulled would say something to the effect of, you know, I feel bad about this, but I don't remember this person. I didn't really know them. Hmm. And can I go back to class now? There was a lot of that. And then, yeah, so we did that. Hundreds of kids we met with. And then like a month or two later, there'd be a new suicide, someone that wasn't on anyone's radar. Even though we had these huge teams of people, even talked to other kids, who of your friends are you worried about, that sort of thing, which is also probably not a good idea, making the kids kind of have this codependent relationship with each other. You just think about that, the fear and the anxiety just ruled the school. Part of it is genuine fear and caring. Part of it, I think, also was just them wanting
projecting
to, well, they were being blamed, and so they wanted to be able to say they needed to announce, we checked in with this many students and we did all of this prevention, so we did everything we could, we're doing everything right. They made me do it. I actually didn't want to. I remember being frustrated because we actually had a huge list of referrals of kids we knew that really could use our support and our check-ins. It was especially because the first ones in the beginning of the year, kids that I knew from the year before needed continued support, you know, after the summer, that wanted to see how they're doing, and we already had parental consent for them. But we had to put that referral list to the wayside and do these kind of mostly useless check-ins. So there was that process. I don't know if other schools do that, but that's what they did. And I think, you know, they were trying to give them the benefit of the doubt, I think they were trying to do the best they could. But this was obviously not based on any kind of data or, you know, procedures that were studied. Like, this is what we need to do. We need to just like check in with every kid to ask them if they're suicidal or not when they get this news. I don't think that's a good idea. I think we should have left them alone.
Yeah, it's not. And there's that, what you just laid out there is rife with problems, not the least of which is the lack of parental consent. And mm-hmm. I mean, Deb Philman does more work than you and I could possibly touch in this podcast, so we'll just leave her in that space. But like, the idea of the school stepping in and violating parental rights is just unconscionable to me. So we'll set that aside and give them the pass, saying that they did it out of the goodness of their hearts, trying to do the right thing. Okay, fine. I can bend my mind to
and out of crisis that, right? Mode. Sure. It was a lot of the crisis mode. We actually did counseling only with parental consent at that time. I don't think that's happening nowadays.
Yeah,
but worked hard to get parental consent in general, like if it was ongoing.
Yeah, and you should, because it's a medical service, right? It's treatment, and usually there's probably a diagnosis rendered at some point, and that's you can't have a blanket authorization for all services. That's grotesque, but it's happening. And I just got word of one literally yesterday from a district locally that has a parental consent for wellness services. Like, well, what's lumped under that? And come to find out, they're asking their school counselors to put diagnoses, school counselors, not licensed to diagnose or treat, put diagnoses and treatment plans in an electronic health record, and apparently this is all building to bill Medicaid. Okay, fine. Everybody wants their honeypot. Oh, no. But the idea of violating parental consent in a crisis can sort of be arrived at a reasonable ollie-ollie oxen-free, it's a crisis, it's exigency. Okay, fine. I'm not interested in dying on that hill. However, when you're doing it every single time a critical incident occurs, that's no longer exigent. That's reactive. And it tells me that you're failing to plan ahead. So the school district I work with most closely, and we've been doing this here for several years now, Zephyr Wellness works with Pershing County School District. It's in the middle of Nevada. It's about 90 miles east of Reno. And they truly have nothing. They have no services. They have a hospital out there, and they have some rural clinics from the state. But without us, their kids aren't getting served. So for about 7 years now, they've been doing the first we're in year eight, I think. The first 5 years were under a Project Aware grant. They did signs of suicide screenings. And the idea was to introduce services, if necessary and desired by the parents, to the school for kids who couldn't otherwise access them. Great idea. One agency started
it. That's
what
I was doing.
Yep.
Similar.
Yeah.
I'm questioning it all now.
Well, I think there's a right way to do it. And I think we're doing it the right way. And I hope I'm not blinded by my own confirmation bias on this. So check me. But
I don't know.
They do it annually. The one agency that started it was committing Medicaid fraud, and they disappeared and blew out of town. So Zephyr stepped in year, I don't know, four or something. And we've carried it ever since. And it's very, very successful. We've actually changed the culture from, I'm suspicious of all things mental, to, yeah, I'm the parent of this kid, and I could probably use some too. Like it's a pretty cool culture shift, but it's still an opt in. It's not an opt out, so it's not mandated for everybody. They're all invited to participate. It's once a year. It's very formulaic, and the kids who screen high are pulled out. There's a multi-tiered systems of support model, where you know, all kids get touched with the basic information. The kids who need a little bit more maybe are put into groups, and then the kids who need one-on-one services, they're the top of the tier, and that represents 1-3% of the population. And there's consents along the way, and it's formalized medical care, and it's quite good. I don't think that we've created a contagion in Pershing County. So far, so good. People are getting well, not worse, but it is intentional and it is structured and it is very formulaic. Like I said, what you're describing happened there was reactive. It was done out of emotion. And I don't think there was intentionality behind it other than when I said projection, it was the administration's or the faculty's projection of fear and shame and guilt onto the kids. Well, we're hurting. They must be hurting. Let's check it. Mm-hmm. And then lo and behold, the kids didn't even know the student who died, right? And that happens all the time. You get the anonymous kid who just kind of floats in the shadows and nobody ever pays attention to him. And then they disappear one day and everybody goes, who? Right? Which is even worse, because it makes the adults feel even sadder about it, that they even let this kid slide off the radar. But here's another point that you bring up, and I don't know if you intended to, but some years ago we had Matt Miller on this show as well as the Walk the Talk podcast. And Matt is the director of the VA's National Suicide Prevention Program. And Matt was the first one to put in my head the idea that suicide's not preventable. And it's kind of one of those, what do you mean, moments. And he says, well, you know, when I was working at the Air Force Base and Michigan or wherever he was, he says, I lost two people, including my best friend, when I was director of the whole mental health thing on the base. And he says, I get this idea that if we're telling people that suicide's preventable, what you're creating is an expectation that somebody is responsible for the prevention. And when that fails, you have an irrational shame and guilt that ripples across the entire community, because the entire community is allegedly held accountable for the prevention.
That's exactly what we felt.
Right.
I felt it too. I was the head of a counseling center at the school, but I never met any of those children that died. Not
right.
One. I didn't know any of them.
Yeah.
Even though I was meeting hundreds and hundreds of kids with mental health issues.
Yeah. And so there's this implied responsibility for something that you can't possibly be responsible for, because at the end of the day, we still have autonomy and free will, as mm-hmm. do the children or adults. And so his point was not to just throw everything out the door and say, let's not try. It's to say, let's try to balance this with some reason and logic that suggests that we can make really good efforts, but no one knows the interior motivations of a human being other than that human being. And if they just choose at the end of the day to do what they do, there's very little that the rest of us can do. And we should not carry that shame and guilt irrationally. And certainly I would take that point to say, we shouldn't carry it so irrationally that we then intrude into other people's lives and pull kids out of class and ask them, right? Like that's doing more harm. And I think that's why we're talking about this, is like, at what point do we recognize that we're possibly causing harm?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The other thing I want to mention that became really widespread there, and it's probably in a lot of communities, is the suicide prevention classes that everyone was given.
You mean like safe talk and stuff? To.
That QPR question, what is it? What does it stand for? Question something respond. I can't remember what it stands for now. But it's that mentality of you can ask someone if they're suicidal. That's not going to make them suicidal. I don't think that does, but I don't think it's good to keep asking people if they're suicidal.
Right, right.
I think it's not good for just a social environment, especially of teens. And they had it available. I don't think before that year they did this with the minors, but they had the teens take it too, so that they could assess their own friends and ask questions and say, ask them if they're okay, basically. So they made everybody just be codependent in this community. And there are certain, and it was interesting to watch, you know, the types of people who would respond to this. So of course there were the more attention seeking types that would, you know, look for help in an unhealthy manner. And because everybody was so anxious about suicide, there was an overreaction often. And the attention seekers figured that out. So they got out of class. They got more people to show them that they care. You know, we're talking about teenagers in general. And then you've got, you know, the ones that would just be more likely to do that. And then there were, I met a lot of the kids who were more of the caretakers and would land more in that codependent style, where they felt overly responsible for their friends that did have mental health issues. I remember there was this one girl who had, I would say she had real clinical depression. She wasn't an attention seeker. This was in 2015, before everybody was putting it on their TikTok. Yeah. And she was generally having some kind of clinical depression. However you frame that nowadays, you know, everyone has their different frameworks, but it seemed like legit. She was having depression, and she would even say, like, I don't even know what I'm sad about, but I'm really sad and it's really hard for me to function and things like that. And her friends were really worried about her. But then they were holding that on their shoulders in this way that I just felt was really unhealthy. And the adults were reinforcing that, as opposed to saying, you're a kid too. You don't need to take care of your friends. You know, we will handle it. But instead, because the adults were so wackadoodle and anxious and overreacting, the kids learned that the adults were not the ones that they could trust. So they felt more responsible, which I think just made the dynamic even worse.
Wackadoodle, by the way, is a clinical term. There is an F code. I can't remember what it is, but we can bill for that. Clinically wackadoodle. You're bringing up a point that I've made elsewhere with regard to employment, usually, and sometimes sitting on boards or coalitions, which is responsibility without authority. And it's a really, really toxic situation when you give somebody responsibility without the authority to do anything. Children are simply not developed to do that. And it's highly inappropriate of us, I would say downright pathological, for the adults to introduce this to children, and like you said, put it on their shoulders when they legitimately have no authority anyway. They're not adults. They're not legally, attaining the age of majority anyway. But then what are they supposed to do? Tell the adult, who then already implied that they're abdicating their responsibility by shuffling it down to the children? Like that's horrific.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, what else do we do this with? Like, pretty much nothing. I get that suicide is the end of life, right? There's no coming back from this. Whereas maybe if we were asking people to do drug screens on each other, maybe it's less serious because you can always recover from drugs or something. But like, we don't do this with any other critical. I know, but it's not even uniform, is my point. It's like, we're not asking them to check in and be like, hey, how's baseball going? We're not asking them to ask about hobbies and interests and see if they want to go into band, you know, like it's just suicide. And there's this very weird offloading of responsibility and authority from the adults. And I'm with you on that. We should not be asking children to be responsible for their peers' livelihoods or lives. And yet that's exactly what we do with our signs of suicide screening and our depression screens, is where we say, is there anybody you're worried about? However, at least yeah. in that case, it's anonymous and the adults can pull them out and they say, you know, somebody wrote your name down as being worried about you. But the adults are done taking the authority.
You're making someone think about that in a way that's, I just don't think that's healthy, actually. And there's a lot of overreactions with it.
How did we get here? Because so, you and I didn't go through this in our schools. And we were, yeah. we're fine. What the hell? Like,
I remember in high school, the big blow was there was a student who died in a car accident. So there was that. But we didn't have like grief counselors come on campus. I don't remember. I remember they announced it on the PA system. And that was
and that life moved on.
Our day. They didn't make us all do grief counseling. Like, that's the other thing. They would bring all these grief counselors. There was actually an agency. They were called CARA. I don't remember as an acronym. I can't remember what it stood for. And I even wanted to work for them. I thought they were cool. But they would come to the schools every time there was some kind of tragedy. And they would actually, they would make an announcement. You know, the grief counselors are here. And they would be in the office and no kids would come. So to use up their time, we'd make these big lists and have people basically be forced to go see these grief counselors.
Yeah, no, who's asking, right? I did a lot of work in rural, I still do, a lot of work in rural Nevada. And I'd sit around these tables with people with fancy degrees and titles and letters. And we'd sit there and talk about how under-resourced the community was and how they need more. And it's like, are they asking? And then it became, but they're just not aware of how much they need it. And it's our job to teach them. Like, whoa, that's really imperialistic. And it seems like a violation of autonomy. You can introduce a concept to somebody and teach it with an open hand and then like sit back and be available. But to crowbar in from your own worldview that somebody else needs something seems really condescending to me. And that's what we're doing to these kids in these schools. And I don't know that it's doing well. I think from one perspective, there's a really beneficial, good-hearted intervention that says, hey, you know, let's tend to emotional functioning because there's a high likelihood that if something happens, you don't address it and things get worse. However, and I say this frequently, and it's gotten me some blowback from certain people who don't think like this, but, you know, humanity got here over the last 40,000 years without our profession, which has only been around for like 100. So maybe we shouldn't take ourselves so seriously. And to that point, if quote unquote resources are needed or education is required, then can't we just publish it and let people download it as they see fit? And why do we have to cram it in through the school curriculum? Why is it required viewing? I mean, I don't understand that. Where was the what is the problem we're trying to solve here? And are we creating one?
Yeah.
Are we doing it just to justify our own existence? Because I can tell you that suicide intervention as it currently is formatted, which is teaching people to react in crisis, to intervene right at that point of despondency when like things are really critical, that ain't how you stop suicide. That's how you stop that particular suicide, maybe. But you're also, again, inviting somebody to take on that responsibility when maybe it's not even theirs to carry. So we'll just call the suicide interventionist or, you know, call the 988 line and download your problems to the person on the other end. But what about like just keeping people healthy? Can't we, wouldn't it be a better beneficial, more beneficial expenditure of time and resources to compel kids, if we're going to compel kids into doing something, shouldn't it be like basketball or the trumpet? Why is it not looking at their friends? Right. Yeah. I don't know.
And the thing I've really questioned, this is ironic for me because I was a school-based counselor and supervisor for over 10 years, like pretty much half of my career. But I'm questioning the entire thing because, and I remember this being a struggle even and concerned about this even at the time. It's really hard to get the parents involved when you're doing school-based counseling, just by the nature of it.
Right, because it's during work hours.
it's during work hours. The kids are at school, they're in class. You have to juggle a bunch of kids in your schedule. It's hard to schedule even a parent who might be willing. It's hard to schedule them in. But we made an effort, my team, mm-hmm. and I was supervising a group of therapists on a school, and a lot of my supervision was call those parents, find out what's going on at home, hear another point of view, get the parents in, talk to them now before there's a crisis so you can work together if and when there's a crisis, you know, all of that, you know, so that was my perspective, but it was a struggle. A lot of the times because the parents were like, just fix our kid.
Yep.
You know, I got stuff to do. And that was the problem why they probably needed therapy in the first place.
Yeah.
So we're reinforcing that problem. We're kind of reinforcing that idea that some other, like we said offline, like we're outsourcing, parents are outsourcing things that they should be doing on themselves, which is connecting with their kids. And then therapists feel like they're the ones that can do it. And I don't think that's the case.
Yeah.
So I think that, I just think it should be scaled back. I'm not sure if we should eradicate it completely, but I think it should be very much scaled back and maybe just be used just for referrals and maybe for the crisis. I don't think meditation programs and wellness programs and all of that are a good idea, really, because who's running them? They go sideways.
Yeah.
And they're agenda. Not to be trusted.
Yeah. Even if that agenda is as innocent as recruitment into their own agency. And I wrestle with this, right? Like I have these contracts at a various schools, and who are they going to refer to? Me, right? Because I'm right there front and center, but I'm not attached to it. In fact, we frequently say Zephyr isn't the only place in town. There's Great Basin, there's True North, there's Presence, there's Healing Minds, like some trustworthy people that I know, Quest Counseling, you know, like I'm not attached to this. I'm trying to work myself out of a job. That's why I publish things for free so people can digest them as they see fit. But to your point about the fix my kid, I mean, Zephyr's intake consent form has a paragraph under the minor's treatment. The first one says, you know, we understand that you have access to your kid's records. Please also waive that right so that we're not seen as a direct conduit to the parents. We want to create some rapport with the child. And, you know, please don't go pawing through notes. The second paragraph says, we don't do fix my kid. We are compelled to be there at some regularity because as go you, so go your children. You're the executives of your home. You're the leaders. We can't just do some stuff in the office, send them back into the same environment from which they came and expect they're going to change. It's not how it works. So 99 times out of 100, the parents hear that and they go, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, cool. Commit to your treatment. It's not jujitsu. You don't drop them off for an hour and they get some skills. So mm-hmm. with school-based stuff, we are a lot looser with that because we understand the dynamic. And if the kid is really struggling that much, then some care is better than no care. But at the same time,
maybe.
If I believe it, yeah, right. Maybe. But if I truly believe what I've put in my consent form, then I should apply that uniformly and not really make exceptions because we need to get the parents to change the way that they're parenting, or at least look at their kids a little bit closer, which requires a commitment. And I'll say this. I don't know that any other profession does this. We're the only ones. We don't intrusively put dentists into the school. We don't intrusively put optometry into the school because we say, commit to it. If this is important and this is a valuable service, pull your kid out of school and make the appointment, or pull yourself off of work and make the appointment. Mm-hmm. We don't negotiate our rates in any other field. Nobody does that. We're the only ones who are like, oh, well, if you can't pay, I guess that's okay. Just dig the change out of your cushions and I'll take 75 cents for my time. No, you're devaluing everything that we do. And you're sending a message that it's not worth the commitment to, you know, skip a meal or a Starbucks or the cigarettes to save for the appointment. So I think we are really creating more problems by violating our own professional boundaries and ethics. But I don't know because I wrestle with it. I see people ailing and, you know, well, there's an opportunity here. If the kid's suffering so badly from bullying that he can't focus on math, well, we might as well pull him out of math anyway so he can learn some self-efficacy 1 hour a week. I don't know.
But does he?
I don't.
That's the question, right?
Yeah.
I'm in a weird state because I'm questioning everything. And yeah, I just don't, I'm not sure. I do remember back in the past, there was this mentality, and now it's even more, where the more the better. Because I remember there were kids who already had an outside therapist that the parents did bring them to. I don't know how good or bad that therapist was and how involved the family was with that therapist, but that everybody involved with that kid would say, well, we want our kid to see you, you know, my team on campus also, so that they had support at school. So there's this like this constant, like, we need to kind of baby this child, this kid, because we think they have so many problems. They have to see all of these therapists.
One of my favorite phrases, right, that I absolutely loathe, I say favorite tongue in cheek, obviously, wrap them in services. Wrap them in services. Why? What? Wrap them in a services. Family. Wrap them in a family. Wrap them in services.
That was from, I heard that term back in the 90s. I think it came from the foster care system. So probably. That's when they didn't have a family.
Yeah.
So they had wraparound services, mm-hmm. which meant, you know, the social worker, the doctor, the case manager, the different adults that were looking after this kid. But of course, as everything, they expand it to other kids that have families. So that's where that term came from. Well, but more is not always better, is my point. Sometimes it's even worse. It could make more problems.
I think this is why intentionality is my favorite word. Know why you do what you do. Know the motivation and the reasons, and not just because you're looking for some output. That's not the motivation. We have to be goal centered. It should be measurable. It should be time limited. And then we reach for our intervention strategies, and we still want to know why we reach for the intervention strategies that we do. So, for example, if we look at some kid that we perceive as ailing, we really have to check ourselves and make sure that it's not our worldview and our own projective identification that's making this kid look, quote unquote, not good, whatever that looks like. Could be lower grades than we would like. Could be not as active or engaged as we would like. Could be participating in fewer activities than we would like. It's all about us. There is no standard, right? And not to sound all postmodern, but individuals are individuals, and we don't get to apply a uniform standard to everybody. That's what makes us individually awesome. So if some kid really likes art and he's terrible at science, I'm going to probably try to push art into his life to make him really happy. I'm not going to sit there and just hammer him about the head and shoulders, say, get better at science to satisfy my own projection. That's about me at that point. Same thing with emotional functioning. You see kids in college. She's a little off, you know, standoffish. She's a little aloof. She doesn't really participate. I think she's depressed. You know, or I think she has ADHD. It's like, fix her, make her what I need her to be. It's like, well, now you're just making kids conform to your vision of what they should be. SEL. No. Just let them be. They're kids. They're going to be different, right? They're all different. So
you brought up two things. Well, one is, who knows if they're really struggling at all, but let's just say they are. Is counseling or mental health services, is that the solution?
No, it's an IEP. No, I'm just kidding.
Right. Like we're hammering these solutions that might be creating more problems. And that's something I've really been looking into. And then, what was the other thing you were saying? I had in my head. Now I forgot it.
We could hover there for a second and realize that, like, by simply introducing the services, quote unquote, we're sending a meta message to the kid that they're broken and that they need this form of help.
That was what I was going to say. The overdiagnosing.
Yeah.
We're telling these kids that they have all these problems and diagnoses, and that hangs over them. And I think that might actually perpetuate the problem as opposed to solve it.
I agree. I mean, we've swung the pendulum pretty far from nobody talks about mental illness to everybody needs a therapist.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's like therapy is like brushing your teeth. Like it's just maintenance. No, it's
not. No, it isn't.
Yeah.
Now, I do, however, believe that if we're going to be treated seriously as a medical profession, that we need to have insurance pay for preventative care, just like every other medical intervention. You know, 4 times a year, pop the hood, check the belts and hoses, no diagnosis needed. But right now, as it stands,
I don't know if I agree with you on that.
I think it's but notice my qualifier. If we're going to be taken seriously as a profession. Now, remember what I just said earlier. We probably shouldn't take ourselves so seriously because human beings have been healing each other for thousands of years without us formally doing it in the form of talk therapy, right? Through the westernized lens of, European psychiatrists of the 1900s. Okay. But if that's true, and that's a good thing, and we want to hire a professional who's specifically trained to do the thing, just like anybody can fix a car, but you need the right tools and you need the right knowledge and the right YouTube videos. Right. Okay. Same with us. You can fix yourself. You don't need me. I could probably accelerate it because I got a unique skill set and I was specifically trained for this and I've gone through thousands of hours of practice. I don't know why we wouldn't just pay for that. Just to go, hey, you know, well, I think I'm a little off, struggling. What's your perspective, right? I want to know your pushback on why that can't be the case, because right now, in order to even see someone, if you think you're a bit lost or off, or you don't know where you're going in life, or you're having some friction with your kids or your spouse, you and I need to render a diagnosis just to get reimbursed by the insurance company. Now, insurance is a whole scam altogether that we don't need to get into. But if we're going to take this seriously, and we're still going to nest it within medicine, and we're still going to nest it under the insurance model, well, then we need to be doing preventative care, not just intervention services when things are too bad and you're broken. Please go. Challenge me.
Okay. I think I don't agree. I think I've shifted. Abigail Schreier has been talking about this with her new book, especially with kids.
I need to read that.
I think when it comes to adults, it's a little different because you're an adult and you can know when things are helping or not. You can
say
the medications are making you feel numb or not. And kids don't really have as much say. They kind of just have to go because someone's dragged them there.
I was meaning adults, by the way, not children.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
So
your argument just went poof.
But they're focusing more on the kids than the adults with this. So
yeah. Kids in therapy should not be a thing. Parents in therapy should be a thing.
More, for sure.
Years ago, I'm going to tell this story to frame what I'm going to say next. Years ago, I really wrestled with the idea of whether or not there was a circumstance in which a spouse or a well-meaning partner should not be in the therapy office, assuming that they're coupled and committed. However that looks, state-sanctioned license or whatever, right? And it took a solid 18 months of weekly consultation around the office before we finally landed on, no, there's never a circumstance under which you wouldn't invite in a spouse to help whoever you're working with. And
I think it all always depends. I just think there's never a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, for sure. But for the purposes of this mental exercise, I don't want to be overly rigid, right? But for the purposes of mental exercise, let's say the traditional excuse was we don't want to expose the husband to the wife's trauma from childhood or whatever. So we'll work with her, quote unquote, individually. They're married. There's problems in the marriage because of her childhood trauma. They don't have intimacy, whatever. We absolutely bring him in. And to think that it's our job as clinicians to intercede and protect him from some things that he doesn't want to hear or whatever is foolish, because we're ostensibly saying that he's not capable of hearing those things or handling them, when that truly is the thing that they need to work on. And also we're assuming she gave permission, right? She wants to share. Of course. We're going to presume that if they're in this committed relationship, we'll call it a marriage, that they're committed, they need to rely on each other, because relying on us 1 hour a week isn't sufficient. They're with each other or someone else the other 167 hours. So we'll take another example, which is usually like, well, it's not the couple's drinking problem, it's the husband's drinking problem, right? So she doesn't need to be in the session. No, she absolutely needs to be in the session because she needs to learn. Exactly, right? Yeah. So I would say the same dynamic for trauma history, for whatever, right? Okay. Apply that to a child now, that same philosophy, that same mental exercise. The parents didn't have anything to do with the child getting teased on the playground and called names. Yeah, but they're supposed to be there to help him build
parents,
resilience,
though.
Right?
Yeah.
Maybe he got inappropriately touched by another kid or some adult at the gym or whatever. Yeah, but the parents are there as the support system, not the therapist. There is no.
Yeah, I was say, why does the therapist any more qualified to help the kid with those kinds of things, incidents? Those aren't like mental illness type things. Those are just life stressors. So why can't a parent help a child learn how to deal with, overcome you know, face right. life stressors.
Right. I don't know a situation. So similarly, I don't know a situation where we wouldn't put the parents first. I can't think of one. Assuming the parents are healthy, right? If you got some cluster B parents who are causing the problem, that's a different issue. But we're assuming reasonably workable, functional, healthy family, you know, and I don't even care if it's a split household. That doesn't matter. Like, get the parents in, because the child is at the center of it, and it doesn't matter what the child's struggling with. The therapist doesn't have authority. The parents have authority. And if you're going to hire a therapist, the therapist needs to work with the parents first and foremost, not the child. Child should be second. And it's a complete inversion of what we were taught in school. And I understand that. And I understand that, being the social pariah that I am to my community, like, this is not new to me. But I can't even have these conversations. I'm really thankful that I can have these conversations with people like you and Stephanie and some others. But I can't even have these conversations in most of the mixed company in my own field here in Northern Nevada, because it's just like they plug their ears and go, no, that's not it. That's not how it goes. Well,
yeah.
Why couldn't it be that way? It seems way more efficient to me to start with the parents and not the child. And these parents who come in with, you know, like, well, I need counseling for my 11-year-old, my 9-year-old, my 7-year-old, because there's depression, anxiety, and ADHD. It's like, no. First of all, I'm not going to put multiple appointments on the calendar. Yeah. You know, like, why.
Maybe that's the therapy right there. You're a parent diagnosing your kids, basically assuming your kid has all these problems that it could be just, it could be a lot of things.
Yep.
I think I'm noticing that trend a lot, that parents don't, they see their kid struggling for one reason or another, and they like to have this sort of external locus of control, like, oh, they just have this, so that's why, as opposed to a whole host of reasons.
It's not me, you know, and my bad boundaries. It's the right? Sagittarius acting up.
Exactly. You know, it could be, even if they have good boundaries, like, there could be other reasons. There could be, you know, their nutrition. I don't know. I noticed this, that there's this comfort level in parents to just label their kids so that they don't have to face their own behaviors and the dynamics in their own home.
And absolutely.
And the therapist, instead of saying, hey, cut that, they reinforce it. Because, we're like all the hammers and there's all the nails. When you're that hammer, everybody looks like a nail with a diagnosis. And I just think it's a healthy way to look at things.
I agree. And I can tell you that the response that we get from the people who come through the front door of our clinic is overwhelmingly favorable. Very, very rarely. Because we do it tactfully and diplomatically. I mean, you and I are getting a little, or at least I am. My tone of voice is getting a little sharp here, and I understand that. But we do it tactfully and diplomatically, and we say, look, the problem's got to end with you. I don't care where it started, but it has to end with you. You're the adult. Right. You're the chief enforcer, right? Like, you're the guide. You're the one who sets the tone in your home. I don't care if it's a split parent household. It doesn't matter. Someone has to take the lead. And I think there's been too much blame shifting and outsourcing of responsibility and accountability to external circumstances, like diagnoses, like the bully on the playground, like the Sagittarius that's acting up or whatever it is. And not enough says, buck stops here. I'm going to take charge of my home and I'm going to set the tone. Yeah. And I think that when we present that, the reason it's been overwhelmingly favorable is because deep down people know it's true. And they may not they may not want to look super deep. It may be really scary to examine some of those old wounds that you got to patch back up properly. But I'll also tell you that overwhelmingly, people have never heard that before. And they've been in counseling a lot. They come in here and they're like, right, why are you the first time in, 5 years and 4 therapists that I've ever heard this thing that makes complete sense? It's like, I don't know. We're lazy and we pick low-hanging fruit. I don't know.
Therapists want to be liked, so they don't probably be afraid to say things.
Probably. It's good for business, too, to keep people on the calendar.
Yeah. Like, what I see a lot of, because I'm in the gender space, that, of course, most of the parents I meet, they're very loving. They're great parents. Like, they're not bad parents, however you even measure that. But they don't believe in themselves. There's a lot of that, where they're kind of like, I don't know what to do, and they're kind of
floundering, a great point.
And they're freaking out. And so a lot of, I think, what my role is, to fully disclose, I don't have kids. I've had a disability. I got married a little late. I don't have my own kids. I think a little bit what's happened, my role on the internet, and I'm known as the truthful therapist online, because I've kind of become a little bit of that parent figure for some parents.
Yeah.
And I'm not parenting them, obviously, but what I'm doing is I'm telling them the message that you know what to do and you need to believe in yourself, because I believe in them. And that's a lot of even what my book says, is to believe in yourself, to question if something doesn't feel right to you, to question it and not go along with it just because you think that your opinion doesn't matter, or, you know, someone else is smarter or something. That's to always believe in yourself, regardless of how many letters anybody in the room has. You're the mom, you're the dad. The buck stops with you, and to believe in yourself, and you love your child more than anybody else. And I think that gets lost in the therapy space. I think therapists are really nice, and they're really good at kind of having this soft tone of voice and getting people to do things that they don't feel comfortable with. And that's really where I think a lot of the tone of the gender stuff is. That's what I write about in my book, is for you to believe in yourself. These are some things you can do. Look inside yourself, look inside the dynamic of your family, and set boundaries with your child. They may say they hate you for it, but they know that you love them because you're the mom. And, you know, I think a lot of parents are worried to upset others. And for some reason, I don't know where we went sideways in our culture, where parents stop believing in themselves as parents.
I think I do know. And I'll tell you that what you're laying out, because I want to talk about your book too. I haven't gotten it yet, cause I'm a bad friend, but, okay. What you're talking about, there's something gender distress.
Practical response to gender distress. Tips and tools for families. And I really should have made an easier title.
Yeah, well, you know, somebody didn't ask me for feedback. What you're talking about there is something I discovered recently. I sort of knew all along, but I didn't really put words to it. A buddy was asking, he was just lamenting. He's another little league baseball coach friend of mine. He says, I'm not really good with confrontation. It's hard for me. And I said, you know, I can teach you that. I'm actually trained in grad school to be confrontational, because we have to confront people's irrational beliefs, their patterns and habits, whatever, right? And what you're talking about there is you're confronting people in their belief system about themselves and saying something that they have not considered. And you ask a really good question there, which is, how did this come to be? How did our society go so sideways? And it wasn't sudden. It was gradual. And then it was sudden. And it's the postmodern movement. Postmodernism, and specifically postmodern deconstructionism, says that nothing is real and everything is to be deconstructed, because if it's a construct, it's just made up anyway, and we can make up stuff as we go. And very quickly that becomes, there is nothing real, nothing is true, and then people become unanchored. And when you're unanchored, you're adrift. And when you're adrift, you're just bouncing off of other things. And if those things are also not anchored, exactly, you can be manipulated. And if at a minimum, if those other people that are also unanchored, and we see this in children all the time, all they're doing is they're projecting out things that they would like to be, or that they wish they could see, or whatever. And then the recipient reflects back. And so they're just bumping and bumping and bumping, and nobody is mm-hmm. anchored. So the fact that you
kids
even
need the truth, you do need to be anchored.
Your exactly. handle as the truthful therapist is itself an anchor to people, because truth can't be avoided. It needs no defense. It needs no advertisement. It binds and it penetrates. And when you speak truth to people, like things like, you're deeper than you realize, you have more than you think you have to offer, you've got this. They intrinsically know that, because mm-hmm. they do, because the human being is infinite in its capacity to do things. So when you see through people's outward behaviors and into the soul of who they are, it's very much in alignment with Christian Conti's yield theory, you're mm-hmm. speaking truth that they can't escape. And they know and believe. However, what gets in the way, I think, is that they've had a history, childhood, Gen X, we were the original trophy, you know, participation trophy people who never really had to be held accountable for our failures. we got little shiny objects anyway. But then it goes into postmodernism, and then it gets into instant gratification society. And I don't know that people, by and large, have had practice standing on their own two feet in the face of adversity or distress or disequilibrium, such that they then have confidence to do it again, because they don't have any history to back them up and say, I got this. So when they see their children, they go, I don't know what to do. And I'm surrounded by a bunch of people saying, don't wreck your kids. Kids are pretty hard to wreck, as it turns out. But don't play fast and loose with that either. And so they're afraid to set limits because they don't like to see pain because they themselves don't know how to tolerate it. And yeah, it turns out pain is tolerable.
They don't let kids feel any pain. Mm-hmm. I just want my kid to be happy all the time. And they don't grow. So they're protecting them, and then they don't learn resilience.
Which is John Haidt's work. Mm-hmm. Talk about your book with the really long, overly cumbersome title.
Yes, I know. And I've even said it wrong on podcasts. I was just on a PragerU interview, and I didn't even know the own title of my own book. So,
market for good marketer.
Okay. So this book is written for the normies, I say. So it's for people who are kind of already deep in it, but it's really for people who are just recognizing that our field, the mental health field and the medical field, are very ideologically captured. And there's been a lot of lies that have been told to all of us, in particular to parents, that their child will kill themselves if they don't get gender affirmation. So I debunk a lot of the lies, that one in particular. This book includes a lot of quotes and artwork from detransitioners. Detransitioners are people who used to believe they were a transgender person, but later realized that they were lied to. And they're the ones that I see as like beacons of hope, that they have found the truth and they have enough humility to admit that. And so it has all of that. And so it has a lot of practical things. I don't really get deep into like clinical language. I don't get deep into the like queer theory, the background and the history of how this all came about. That's like a different book. There are a few books out there that go into that, which are also great. They just have a different purpose. I go into why pronouns, especially for children, are harmful specifically, and ways you can say no and encourage your child to say no and set boundaries and why that's important. I go into things you can say to a counselor that might be pressuring you to trans your kid. And, you know, that this is not clinically appropriate to talk about suicide in front of my child. Why aren't we talking about this other issue that we knew my child had, for example, autism or an eating disorder? So I have a lot of practical things you can say and do. And then I have a whole chapter on ways you can approach a trans-identified teen that's not confrontational, just yelling at them that there are only two genders, or really permissive and going along with it. It's kind of a little bit of an open-ended, more balanced approach. But I have a disclaimer that I don't know you, I don't know your kid, and these are just ideas for you to think about on your own, because I, throughout the book, really give that message that you know yourself and you know your family, and to believe in yourself. And it has a trans English dictionary. So I go through a lot of the trans terms, but you know, from like a sane person's perspective, like I'll explain how certain words are really just ways for the trans people to claim victim status and to flip what's normal and what not normal, so that they kind of understand what's going on, you know, what's going on underneath the surface, and they can kind of go, you know, attack it sideways. So it's just a lot of useful, practical. That's why there's the title, A Practical Response. And some of it's preventative. So I could say just a practical thing to gender distress, because it's just a lot of just very common sense ideas that I think when you're in the thick of it, you get blindsided by all these emotional blackmail threats and professionals that tell you that you're a bad person for not affirming your kid. There's also a whole chapter where I did attend a therapy training just to spy on them and understand wackadoodle they are. And I spell it out what they're doing with how they're teaching parents to basically grieve their cis child. And the word cis means really just their regular boy or girl child. And using the Kubler-Ross stages of grief to you know, help them, to manipulate them, yeah, to believe that they need to affirm their child as trans, and basically set them on a path to sterilizing them, chronic health issues, possibly cancer, blood clots, all kinds of health issues, and then just not living in reality, which, you know, has its own set of harms. So
the weaponized,
it's a practical book.
The weaponized empathy is really hard to stand up under, and I think I know your work well enough to predict what's in that book, and I would assume that what you've provided is something to combat the weaponized empathy in a practical way. Right. And when we say,
that's exactly it.
Yeah. When we say weaponized empathy,
families in crisis, and you're kind of get blindsided, and you just get, when you're emotional like that, it's hard to think anymore, because, and you've got these professionals that weaponize your fears and empathy, and they believe they're doing the right thing. I think most of them are not evil. I think most of them are misguided. A lot of them are being sort of brainwashed by their superiors. Yep. I've been sitting in these trainings, and I see the little swirlies go over my own eyes. If I didn't have this information already behind me, I could easily be manipulated by being trained that this is the kind and nice thing to do. So this book basically counters all of that. So, and it's written with compassion. I think the tone of it, you can tell I'm a therapist, that I have a little bit still of that bleeding heart personality, but it also balanced with the truth and boundaries and firmness, but not in a way that's going to push the kid away, because they are already being trained that you as a parent and people who are against this are the enemy. So I give ideas to be able to approach it. And of course, there's no one answer. It's just ideas.
It's a dialogue now. It used to be a monologue. Yeah. And it's, right. I think there were some very sinister, very pernicious forces at the very outset of this movement, 25, 30 years ago. Really, it was longer ago than that, but what it morphed into in the late 90s and early 2000s was really something quite sinister. And I think it was done out of some heavily cluster B personality disordered people, yeah, who also simultaneously had a financial and economic incentive to sell books, gain control, which satisfies the narcissism or the sociopathy, the histrionics, and also roped in some of the medical community that stood to benefit as well. And we're talking specifically children here, and we're not indicting adults who have peacefully transitioned and are living their lives and want nothing to do with the activism and propagandism that's going on, because there's a lot of that. Unfortunately, that megaphone was very loud, very unidirectional for a very long time. And now we've got people such as yourself and Abigail Schreier and Stephanie Wynn and Colin Wright and many others who are standing up against this. And what we have now is not a backlash. It's finally the introduction of other voices that say, "Wait, yes, hold on, pump the brakes a little
silenced
bit."
Silenced.
Yep, they were willfully.
There were other people who were saying things, but they were silenced earlier and made examples of.
Oh, geez, so, yeah, they sure were. James S's, yeah. But and myself in school.
Him.
Who's that?
In Abigail Schreier's book, she talks about some dissidents that spoke up back in like the early, like in the 2010s.
Oh, yeah.
That were made examples of, people who were in WPATH that were not like the direction it was going in, or people who were leading gender clinics that were immediately fired. So there were a lot of people that said, wait a second, I don't like the direction this is going. And they were just immediately fired and made examples of. And then the activists were brought in. And then they like to say that now they have a consensus, but they don't. They have an appearance.
They have an echo chamber. Yep. And they have control of a narrative, but now they don't anymore, because, you know, triangulation only works when the two of the legs of the triangle don't talk to each other. And now those other legs are talking. And I'll tell you, it's really nice to see the balanced, reasonable pushback using the very same ethics and just countering it, right? And saying, well, okay, you say you're acting out of beneficence. We're saying you're actually being maleficent. You're saying that you're acting out of a sense of justice. We're saying you're violating autonomy. And so now we have a dialogue, and whether or not they want to acknowledge that is immaterial, because the audience is seeing it now. The middle, you know, three standard deviations of the distribution curve are like, oh, so there's there's more nuance to this than just the crazies on either end, right? And I think absent that, lawsuits would eventually come, but now we're going to have lawsuits and dialogue. And the, mm-hmm. the detransitioners that you mentioned who were, in fact, lied to and I would say groomed and coerced and manipulated did not author a fully informed consent. And no. that's going to be the linchpin that undoes all of this. It's wild to me, and I said this before in a different format, that we get told in grad school to be fearful of all these lawsuits lurking around every corner that just don't happen. They don't happen. We don't get sued for anything. If we did, our liability insurance would be a lot higher than it is. As it is, only a couple hundred bucks a year. It's nothing. But what's actually going to happen is these clinicians will get sued for failing to protect. And that is our first admonition is do no harm. And we're dropping the ball. And when that happens, it will have a chilling effect. I hope my own liability insurance doesn't go up as a result, but it probably will, because that's what happens with car insurance when a bunch of people get in collisions. My insurance goes up to offset the cost.
I hadn't thought about that fallout, that the good ones will still kind of get punished.
Yeah, but it'll be worth it, because then we won't be under the pressure from affirming care guidelines issued by the AAMFT that will probably be, you know, worm their way into law, which will worm their way into my licensing requirements. You know, like something like that is really knocking on the door, and that cannot be allowed to happen, because then you revoke my ability to treat as I see fit when I'm having to conform to an ideology that says thou shalt affirm. It doesn't stop at gender. It continues into, I told you my kid has ADHD, treat the ADHD. And I go, well, actually,
it's beyond.
Actually, it's beyond, he doesn't.
Gender. This right. is like a symptom of a bigger problem. This is the way I see it.
Well, Pam, I really appreciate you coming on. I mean, it's been a little over an hour now, and we've covered a lot of topics. Thank you. I'm doing this new thing where I ask people, well, what's something that they're taking away from this conversation? So what are you taking away?
What am I taking away? Well, this conversation, but I just like that you're a therapist that will think outside the box and not go along with what we're told. And I think that's really the theme of this whole conversation, is to question things. And it doesn't even mean we'll come to an answer. Right. It just means we're thinking about it, and we should be open-minded, and not in the way that they say being open-minded, meaning like how you were saying that there is no truth, but be open-minded to the fact that maybe what we thought was true isn't so true, and what was effective maybe isn't so effective, just because everyone's doing it, just because it's the standard. So that's what I take away from this, to just even further question things. And I hope your audience does that.
My takeaway, thank you. I echo that, and I didn't mean to gloss over that compliment. Thank you for saying that. My takeaway is that I might actually not be doing as much good as I think I am in the school-based mental health setting. I gotta spend some time considering that. I think we're helping, but I think we could also do it in a lot more measured sprinkling and not necessarily have to shower people with our presence. I think that's probably my takeaway. Less is more. Make it an invitation, not a command. So, right on.
That's cool. It took me a bit to get there. It's been a really hard thing for me, as someone who's done this and been in this field for so many years and believes so strongly in it, to be like, I wonder if what I was doing really was helping people. Like, I thought I was doing all the wonderful things, and I don't believe I did. I think I did help people. I don't want to say I didn't, but I'm just wondering out loud, like, maybe they would have been fine without it, or maybe even in some cases better without it. And I don't know.
Right.
And I want to think about that a little more. I certainly don't like how therapy speak and diagnoses have been infiltrated in our language and our culture to the level it has. And that's a result of this all being in the schools. And I think it's,
I agree. I agree. And it is hard to question things that you've done for a really long time, especially when they comprise some of what you represent in the community. You know, it's a point of pride. Nobody was doing school-based mental health before Zephyr started doing it. Nobody. Yeah. We set the trend, at least in my community. Nobody's doing a lot of things before we did it.
Access is great. Maybe right. It isn't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe we are better off being the dentists who just are open for business, and we teach you about oral health care, and you come in if you want to, but it's an invitation, not an intrusion.
If you're there with like a really bad cavity, they can send you to the dentist somewhere else, right? Like if you go to the school nurse, if you have some kind of physical problem, the school nurse doesn't treat you. They send you to the doctor. The parent comes and picks up the kid.
I worry about the autonomy too. It's almost like, I did home-based mental health for a really long time too. I'd go into people's houses and man, that was some of the best therapy you could do because you're laying eyeballs right on their milieu. Yeah. Like, oh, is this the family dinner table that's all covered in dust and stacked with crap that you clearly don't gather around, right? Like that's pretty cool. But you know, knock, knock, knock on the door. I'm here for your therapy appointment. Is that really honoring autonomy? They're like begrudgingly opening the door. They're, you know, peering through the blinds. I don't want to see you today. Like, I don't know that's appropriate. And
then they didn't make effort to get there.
Yeah.
And then sometimes just leaving the house is part of the therapy, like getting dressed and,
it's a commitment.
And being outside.
It's a commitment. Yeah. And, you know, and the fancy people around the table with their degrees and letters would say, we need to bring the services to them. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Are they asking? So, well, thanks.
Interesting. It's just interesting questions that are out there for us and your audience to think about.
Yeah.
And I've just been thinking about it more and more, and I still don't have all the answers when it's good, when it's not, because I don't think there's a solid line, but I definitely think less is more at this point.
You let me know when you hit that arrival point, because I would like to know when you have all the answers.
Right. Yeah, sure.
All righty. On behalf of our Zephyr Wellness family and our Noggin Notes team, thanks for listening. Share it around and spread the good word, and let's make Earth better. We wish you all great mental wellness. Bye-bye.